Hey folks, it's Denise Howell, and you're about to listen to a great episode of This Week in Law. Tom Merritt stops by and stays for the whole dang show, God love him. We also have Professor Michael Geist from the University of Ottawa in Canada. We're going to talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that is still lurking out there, a whole lot of issues about digital copyright, and global policy on intellectual property law. We'll talk about some privacy and security issues too, all next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell and Evan Brown, episode 231, recorded October 11, 2013, Taking Up Knitting. Hey folks, it's time for another This Week in Law. I'm Denise Howell. Evan Brown is here as usual. Hello, Evan.
Hi, Denise. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Good to see you.
Great to see you as well. Looking forward to this conversation. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I know, me too. One of my favorite shows on TWiT, aside from our own, of course, is Triangulation. And one of our panelists today, actually both of them, one is a regular to Triangulation, and one was one of the first guests, and that is Professor Michael Geist. He is the research chair of internet and e-commerce law at the University of Ottawa in Canada and a world-renowned scholar of copyright and IP policy. And we're so thrilled to have him. Thank you for joining us, Professor Geist.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun.
Me too. And as I mentioned a minute ago, also joining us from Triangulation and TNT and Framerate and various and sundry other shows on the TWiT network and elsewhere is Tom Merritt. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Denise. It's good to be back on TWiL and good to see you again, Michael.
Yeah, nice to see you.
So I thought what would be fun to do is for anyone who hasn't had the chance, definitely go back and listen to episode 2 of Triangulation. It was recorded in December of 2010. So we're almost 3 years down the road from that recording. I went back and listened to it. And there was a lot of covering ground around how things progress over time and how long it takes for legal and policy change to be affected. So I thought it would be fun to go back and revisit some of the things that you guys discussed there and see where we are and what's happened in the interim and if we've made a lot of progress or a little and if things have gotten better or worse. So I thought we would start on the legislation and policy front and revisit what is going on with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. So back when you guys recorded Triangulation, we were just learning about the nuances that had been leaked of ACTA, which was quite in the news then and wound up sort of fizzling, but also coming to the fore then was the TPP. And we find ourselves in a real similar kind of situation now because it is anticipated to become final perhaps by the end of this year. So Professor Geist, for those of our audience who may not be completely up to speed on the TPP, can you tell us what we know about it, which from my perception is somewhat less than we knew about ACTA, but if I'm wrong about that, please correct me. And also to the extent that we think that it's as bad or worse than ACTA, what are the things that are areas of concern?
Sure, great questions. And I think you're right that unlike ACTA, if we think back to where we were at 3 years ago with the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, there had been a fair number of leaks, and we had a pretty good sense of where things were at. There was mounting international concern, both about the secrecy associated with the agreement as well as with the substance of the agreement. And over a period of time, ultimately an agreement was concluded. It was watered down, I think, from where things were at that point in time. But even with that watered down agreement, still raised concerns. And then ultimately, as you referenced, has fizzled out, though it's not totally dead. It was defeated in Europe. And so the European Parliament voted against it, which effectively killed it amongst all the EU member states. But there are still enough signatories who are outside of Europe to perhaps ultimately bring ACTA into effect. That includes both Canada and the United States, as well as a number of other countries, notably Japan, which has already signed on and actually the first country to ratify ACTA. But even then, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was sort of seen as a potential son of or a child of ACTA, and the likelihood that it would raise many of the same kinds of concerns. And in fact, that's precisely what's happened in many ways. I actually think ACTA raises more significant, the TPP rather, raises even more significant concerns than ACTA. The Trans-Pacific Partnership is a far broader agreement. So while ACTA focused specifically on intellectual property enforcement and counterfeiting issues, which had, of course, impact on lots of different things, but that was really the extent of its purview, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a trade agreement that covers just about everything, everything from investor disputes to agricultural issues to intellectual property. The IP provisions have proven to be amongst the most controversial. And the participants in the TPP, which include the United States, Canada, and Mexico, a number of countries moving down towards South America, such as Chile and Peru, and then many Asian countries, such as Malaysia, now Japan, who is also entering into the process, as well as Australia and New Zealand. So we've got a little bit different geographic dynamic. And the concern with the TPP is that there are far fewer leaks. There was a leak several years ago of the intellectual property chapter, but no real subsequent leaks since. And in many ways, the kinds of provisions from an intellectual property perspective that were at least included in those leaked documents suggest that it would go beyond even ACTA and raises some real concerns. And as you reference, it does appear that there's an effort to put this on a fast track with some hope amongst the proponents of the agreement to get this done by the end of the year, though that seems overly ambitious. It seems unlikely that this will happen by the end of this calendar year, which is at this stage only a few months away.
That's true. Okay, so of those provisions that relate to copyright and the internet, why should we be concerned about the TPP?
Well, in some ways, much like ACTA, it depends a little bit where you're sitting. And so if you're in the United States, not all the provisions will be of concern, because in some ways this is an attempt by the United States as part of these trade negotiations to export some of its rules elsewhere. Although I think it's important to recognize that what the U.S. often does through these trade negotiations, including within the TPP, is export only some of its rules. So it will tend to export the rules that are far more restrictive, things like the anti-circumvention legislation, the rules around digital locks, the copyright term rules. Those kinds of rules from the United States get exported. The flexibilities that exist under U.S. law, things like fair use provisions or provisions that provide legal protection or safe harbors for intermediaries like internet service providers and search engines, those ones don't tend to get exported. And so what's left for many of the countries that are participating in these discussions is what some might see as the worst of U.S. law, some of the most restrictive provisions in U.S. law, but none of the flexibilities. And of course, for those that are looking for the secret sauce of the kind of copyright or the kind of intellectual property rules that you might want to have that encourages innovation, that allows new businesses to emerge, whether internet businesses or otherwise, I think many are of the view that it's the flexibilities far more than the restrictive rules that help facilitate and foster that. But yet that's not what's included in the TPP draft. And so the concerns will depend a little bit on where you sit, because in some countries this will require real change and in other countries not so much. In a country like my own in Canada, there are significant concerns. So a good example, and it's one that affects several of the TPP countries, is on copyright term. I'm sure you recall the fights in the United States over the extension of copyright term a number of years ago, the so-called Mickey Mouse extension, as it was often referred, that Larry Lessig ultimately fought up to the U.S. Supreme Court and lost with the Copyright Term Extension Act that led to an extension in the term of copyright in the United States from life of the author plus an additional 50 years after they die to life plus 70, so essentially extending it by an additional 20 years. The international standard as found in the Berne Convention, which is one of the international copyright treaties, is life plus 50. So the U.S. exceeds the international requirements, but there are a number of countries that are currently at the international standard, and that includes Canada and other TPP countries like New Zealand and Japan. And so there is now pressure as part of the TPP to include a copyright term extension provision that would require countries like Canada and, as I mentioned, some of these other countries to extend the term of copyright. We see other provisions there that, again, try to export U.S. rules. So things on statutory damages, things like notice and takedown rules. Those are the sorts of rules, and even criminal provisions and harsh provisions for this anti-circumvention, for the legal protection for digital locks. Those are all things that many of the other TPP countries have either not adopted or have adopted rules that are not precisely the same as the U.S. and oftentimes with some more flexibility. The U.S. goal through the TPP is, in effect, to export those U.S. rules elsewhere.
Tom, I realize that there is much reason to be concerned about exporting the U.S. copyright regime beyond our borders willy-nilly. But do you think that there might be some good that could come out, perhaps not of this agreement, but just in concept, of having more consistency between the countries as to how things are going to be enforced and what sort of penalties are going to fall? Do you think that the fact that right now we're sort of in a catch-as-catch-can situation where, depending on what country you are, you may have a completely different penalty or right than you would elsewhere. Do you think that international consistency in these areas is a good thing?
Sure. An example is the Beatles going into public domain in the UK, but not in the United States, or orphaned works on books being in public domain, but not in some places of the world, not here. Harmonization of copyright laws absolutely should be a goal, in my opinion. But mm-hmm. we also need first to have reasonable copyright law. We're not asking ever the question, is this achieving the goal? In fact, a lot of people can't even agree on what the goal of copyright law is. Is it to encourage the creative arts, or is it to protect a business model? People disagree on that. And I've seen studies that say that the proper term should be 14 years. So if the international standard is 50 years, that would be well beyond what that one study says. But we haven't even figured out what the optimum protection is if the goal is to encourage the creative arts. And on top of that, what concerns me is the Trans-Pacific Partnership is largely, as Professor Geist pointed out, an economic treaty. And whether you agree or disagree with it, its goals are free trade or easing trade. And so it's easy for something like this to get lost in a way that it didn't in ACTA, where it was more focused on counterfeiting. So that concerns me that some countries that might strenuously object may agree to it because they like other parts of the TPP and it becomes a bargaining chip. Well, okay, we'll go ahead and agree to that because we want these other benefits that we'll get out of the agreement. One piece of hope for me here is that perhaps India does. I don't think they've been included in this, but the U.S. has been pushing to include them. And India wants to protect their pharmaceutical industry from a lot of patent violation, and so they may fight against some of these intellectual property restrictions. I don't know, but that's the only shred of hope I can think of here.
What do you think, Evan? I know that it's difficult to discuss something that is as shrouded in secrecy and confined to knowledge gleaned through leaks as the TPP is here. But are you as concerned about its technology and IP-related provisions as we seem to be in general?
Well, there's plenty to ascertain about which we should be concerned about here, even though a lot of it is shrouded in secrecy. The little bit that we do know is troubling, in as much as it's this concept of what Professor Geist is saying, taking those worst parts of U.S. copyright law and expanding those out, breaking those out onto the world stage. So then to tie in what Tom was saying, sure, harmonization is a great idea, and that's a very apt word, and that's, you know, good job, Tom, for introducing that word to the present discussion here, because that certainly is a good thing in as much as we see more globalization and we just want these worldwide norms to be able to, you know, we need to be able to expect what those norms are. But if we're going to be breaking out worldwide norms, things that are not appropriate and don't take into consideration both sides of the equation or the multiple parts. You know, it's more than just big content versus the individual user. It's much more complex and nuanced dynamic than that. But if we take into consideration all of the different factors that play into this, we want whatever it is that becomes the worldwide norm to be something good. I guess we just don't have as much to worry about here in the United States because we're already used to living under these onerous or draconian points, you know, the huge statutory damages, even for non-commercial uses, as long as it's shown to be willful, you know, up to $150,000 per work. That sounds like something. Correct me, Professor, if I'm wrong. For non-commercial in infringement in Canada, up only $5,000 cap on statutory damages, and of course the shorter copyright term. So we would need to address what those things are before we start thinking about making this a worldwide set of standards. That would be my concern.
And Professor Geist, would that in fact happen if the TPP is adopted? Would, for example, it was the C-32 law, I believe you were talking about in your last visit to the TWiT network, which I think had just been passed in Canada at the time. And you mentioned, as Evan did just now, the $5,000 cap on non-commercial infringement. Would that kind of, what happens when, you know, there's a specific law in the books in Canada and then there's a trade agreement that comes into play that may conflict with that?
Right. Well, that's one of the big concerns that I think certainly a lot of Canadians and I know that I have. So, yeah, back, I guess, in December 2010, it wouldn't have been passed yet, but it would have been introduced. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the law was, in fact, passed. The concerns and what that created was a change in the way Canadian law went. So, actually, it's a good example of how Canadian policymakers saw what was taking place in the United States, especially around these massive lawsuits and the prospect for millions in liability, and said, you know, that's the wrong way to go. Especially when we're talking about non-commercial infringement. And so we kept on the books statutory damages for commercial cases. So, you know, someone that's profiting to the tunes of millions of dollars through IP infringement still faces full statutory damages in Canada, which for us is at $20,000 per infringement. In the case of non-commercial infringement, though, and so this might just be individuals who aren't profiting, obviously, from it, not engaged in any sort of commerce, we have a cap of $5,000 total. It's not per infringement. It's for all infringements combined, a maximum of $5,000. And the goal, I think, of the government there was to say, we don't want to see thousands of lawsuits or these sorts of trolling suits that we've seen from some groups, and we don't think it's appropriate that users could run the risk of, you know, losing their house or going bankrupt on the basis of some allegations of non-commercial infringement. The danger with something like the TPP, because there are provisions, at least in the draft, around statutory damages, is that distinction that Canada has established. And I should note that many of the other TPP countries don't have statutory damages at all, would be required to mirror, largely match, the U.S. approach of very severe statutory damages with no distinction between commercial and non-commercial. As for how this happens in the Canadian context or any other context, is if you sign on, ultimately you've got to make a decision to go further and ratify, bring that law into effect. And once you go ahead and do that, you've got to change your domestic law. You've got to change your rules to be compliant with the treaty. So that would effectively mean in the Canadian case that having just spent in Canada a better part of about 10 years debating copyright reform and ultimately enacting these rules, actually it was just in 2012 when it finally was passed, the government would be forced to backtrack and actually undo some of the provisions, both provisions on statutory damages, provisions on the approach we have for internet service provider liability. We have a different system known as notice and notice. That would be thrown out. Even our anti-circumvention rules, our legal protection for digital locks, didn't go quite as far in terms of things like criminal liability like they do in other countries. And so mm-hmm. The government would actually have to walk back a lot of the kinds of things that it said, struck a fair balance only a year or two ago if it's to become a member of the TPP. And I think, you know, that's why it's a concern in Canada. That's why it's a concern in a lot of other countries. And I think when people hear this notion of harmonization, of course, I mean, who could be against having a common set of rules? But I think, as everyone has highlighted, the danger, in a sense, or the problem is, well, what exactly are those rules? And I have to tell you, when you're sitting in a country of 35 million beside a country 10 times the size, it ends up feeling a lot more like Americanization rather than harmonization, which is ultimately what's taking place in these negotiations.
One of the things I've read is present in the draft that you just alluded to is criminal liability or penalties for infringement. And that's certainly something that would be a drastic step for many countries. Isn't this setting off red flags for those considering these provisions?
Sure, that's a great point. And that actually, the criminalization of intellectual property infringement was one of the big trigger points for ACTA in Europe. And so that idea of shifting towards more criminal style provisions was where there a lot of people objected and really raised considerable opposition. You know, there are at least a couple of problems in the context of the TPP when you say, well, how come we're not seeing the sort of outrage that we saw in ACTA? Part of it is the secrecy that's associated with that agreement right now, so that we've got an agreement that, by and large, is not well known. So let me just an agreement that is not well known amongst many, and the substance of the agreement isn't well known either. And so it's tough for people to get very active and speak out on an issue when, frankly, they don't know the substance of it. The other danger, and was alluded to earlier, is that we're talking about agreement that is not as narrowly defined, let's say, as ACTA. So ACTA, it was easy to focus on the specifics around ACTA because, well, you knew it was dealing with intellectual property. This is bringing a whole series of stakeholders, everybody from dairy manufacturers to telecom providers to winemakers are actively engaged in this because there are provisions that affect their industries. And the kinds of trade-offs that get made may ultimately mean that the intellectual property provisions sort of get lost in the shuffle, or at least in some countries where they may not even like the IP provisions. They may even readily acknowledge that they're not their preferred approach, but they will argue that the benefits that come from many of the other chapters are enough to make the agreement worthwhile.
Seems like the telecom industry would want to get involved and lobby those involved in the decision-making process so that they don't become the gatekeepers on intellectual property-related policing. It seems like the draft is tending toward that direction as well.
Well, I think that's where you'll see, obviously, many of the internet providers and telecom providers become active, is the concern around liability. Interestingly, they have another set of concerns, though, and there are those that believe they will ultimately trade off some of the issues on IP for a separate issue on privacy and data transfers. And so one of the proposals within the TPP is the notion of requiring those countries to not establish provisions that would require cloud-based services to establish themselves within a home jurisdiction. And so as everybody knows, in the post-Snowden environment, we've started to see a lot of countries begin to talk about a desire to not quite go off the grid, but go off a grid that's more easily accessible to the NSA and other intelligence agencies. And one way to try to do that is to require that data be stored locally and not ultimately reside in on servers that may well be located in the United States or across into other borders such that they may be captured. There is actually provisions or proposals to include provisions that would preclude or prohibit a country from establishing some of those kinds of restrictions, essentially saying you can't in your privacy rules establish those kinds of provisions. And for those companies that look at the cloud as being such a critical part of their long-term business model, there are some fears that they'd be willing to trade off, in a sense, a loss on the intellectual property for a gain on these privacy provisions, or from their perspective, a gain on these privacy provisions. And so that's just yet another example of the kind of trade-offs that may often occur in this kind of agreement that touches on so many issues, which suggests that the more conventional allies that many internet users have had, from internet companies and telecom companies, may not be there in the way that they've been there on some other issues when it comes to the TPP. If they're able to achieve gains on issues like that, or even on issues such as foreign investment restrictions, as there are some countries that still have foreign investment restrictions on telecommunications companies, forcing open those markets to foreign investment may be another gain that some of these companies would look to say, well, we're willing to take a bit less on the IP side because we've picked up gains elsewhere.
Well, we'll wrap up our discussion on the TPP here in just a minute. I do want to insert our first MCLE passphrase for this episode of This Week in Law. If you're listening to the show and hoping that perhaps you can get continuing legal education or other professional education credit, we drop these phrases into the show so that you can demonstrate that you've actually listened. And we're going to make our first phrase harmonize or Americanize. Because that will be easy to remember, I think, after the show. If you want more information on getting continuing legal education or other professional credit for the show, head on over to the wiki at wiki.twit.tv to our show This Week in Law, and there is a bunch of good information there for you. Tom, any final thoughts about the TPP and its ramifications?
I don't have any more thoughts necessarily. You know, I think Professor Geist has expressed all the concerns in the situation very well. I wonder if it can be stopped. I wonder, or not stopped entirely, but if the intellectual property provisions can be blocked. I don't have a sense right now of how possible that was. I feel like we did when we were early following ACTA before those first leaks, that it was kind of on an unstoppable path, and we weren't sure if there was any way to get in front of it. Thankfully, Europe was one of the main actors to get in front of that, but maybe I'm missing it, but I don't get any sense that there is anybody particularly in a position to block this from inside anyway.
Yes, that's a good question, Professor Geist. If people are concerned and want to get the word out and want to make their feelings known to those who will ultimately make the decisions on this agreement, I know there are certain organizations such as Open Media out there who are collecting signatures of people who want to voice their concern. Is there anything concrete or specific you feel that people can do?
Well, it does feel like early days, and it's difficult to know how you can stop it. I totally agree that the notion of stopping a major international treaty seems virtually impossible. Yet it did feel precisely the same way with ACTA, and somehow that happened. And so I suppose hope springs eternal. On this issue here, I mean, I think the starting point is, of course, to pressure our elected officials in all countries to at a minimum demand greater transparency as part of this process right now. Because one of the ways, I think, to begin to rally opposition to some of the worst in these treaties is to actually know with some amount of credibility what is in these treaties. And at the moment, it's tough when all you're relying upon is leaks. I appeared actually just a number of months ago before a parliamentary hearing here in Canada on the TPP, and government members of parliament responded first by saying, you know, how can you actually criticize an agreement that you haven't seen, which of course is, you know, their own doing. So it's a bit difficult to, you know, if you just make it available, I'd be happy to critique it on that basis. And of course, their other argument was, well, there's really nothing to worry about anyway. Why don't you just wait until the end of the process? Then you'll see the treaty, and Canada, like all countries, can decide whether or not to sign on to this. But of course, we all know that once that process has come to a conclusion, there is no ability to reopen it. And that's, you know, if that means that the whole thing goes down and it's a bad agreement, well, then so much the better. But if we ultimately end up in a bit of this kind of horse trading where there are benefits, but there are also some real problems, I think the fear is that on issues surrounding intellectual property and privacy, we're going to lose out. And the only way to stop that is, I think, to speak when whatever country we happen to be, to demand that these kind of agreements have far more sunlight and that the positions that are taken, especially if you're in the United States, the positions that are taken are consistent with U.S. law, not just on the restriction side, but on the flexibility, the limitations and exceptions, the user rights, as our Supreme Court of Canada has described them when it comes to things like fair use.
All right. Well, we're going to slide into some stories in the realm of entertainment that still, I think, come back to these issues that we're talking about with the TPP, as I think you'll see in a second. So we had the Breaking Bad finale happen in the U.S. and I assume elsewhere. I don't know. Maybe, Tom, you know better how this show is distributed in other countries.
Yeah, it was on Netflix, I think, in the U.K.
Uh-huh.
Like as a Netflix original. So they got it as soon as it aired in the U.S.
There we go. So despite its availability on TV and on Netflix, it was downloaded more than 500,000 times illegally in a 12-hour period right when. Do you know, Tom, was that before or after it actually was distributed and widely available? I mean, it just seems odd to me that.
That's a good question. I don't know what the time breakdown. Most of it is after, because that's when the measuring was done. But I assume that there was probably some kind of early leakage, at least in real time, if nothing else.
Yeah. No, and the coverage I'm looking at here, which is on Eric Gardner's site, Hollywood Esquire, via Torrent Freak, says it was within the first 12 hours after the episode aired. So, you know, illegal downloading is alive and well, despite things being available in other forms. But according to professors at the London School of Economics, which I never really have thought of as a place that was anything other than staunchly business friendly, big business friendly, corporate friendly, scholars there have found that sort of event, the illegal downloading of Breaking Bad or anything else, actually isn't harming sales and revenue to those rights holders involved in the show. So what the London School of Economics study has found is that contrary to the claims in the entertainment industry, it's still holding ground and showing healthy profits, and that digital sales are not being impacted and, in fact, may be benefiting from the sort of activity that we're talking about here with Breaking Bad. So immediately, of course, the MPAA had their own statement out attempting to debunk the London School of Economics study. But I think just the fact that it is coming out of that particular entity is telling, and again harkens back to our discussion of the TPP, which has been critiqued all along as its various drafts have leaked for being very business friendly and not consumer friendly. So Professor Geist, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the London School of Economics study and the notion in general that piracy is not actually devastating the content holders.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think this study is one of a number of studies that are reaching the same kind of conclusion, looking at this in a number of different ways. And while there are, of course, counter studies often funded by groups like the MPAA or other lobby groups that have reached the counter conclusion, we're starting to see a body of literature that finds that at the end of the day, the financial impact of a great deal of what's described by some as piracy or infringement isn't significant when we start thinking about the bottom line. And in fact, there was even a study that was commissioned here in Canada by the Canadian government on peer-to-peer file sharing a number of years ago that found, and I suppose it's almost intuitive, that those that download are often the biggest purchasers of music as well. I think what we're starting to see more and more of is a recognition that in many instances, the piracy rates in some countries are really a business model failure more than anything else, not a legal one. And it's a function in many instances of whether it's Hollywood or whatever the industry happens to be, of offering up reasonably priced services with the same kind of with the convenience, the portability that users, I think, by and large, have come to expect. In other words, sort of meeting consumer demand with what consumers are looking for, as opposed to what the businesses themselves are looking for. there was a report in Canada, I think it came from a Netflix executive, that indicated that torrenting in Canada has fallen dramatically in the couple of years since Netflix came here. And, you know, I think that the thought there is that, you know, before the entry of Netflix, which in Canada is as a download-only service, and that's how it started, via streaming, that without that service, users who are looking for this kinds of content would often look to pirated versions, let's say, or infringing services, in part because there wasn't a viable, legal, reasonably priced alternative. And of course, you bring in Netflix, which now has more than 2 million customers in Canada out of a population of 35 million. It's proven very, very popular in a short period of time. And so it's unsurprising, in a sense, that when you have those alternatives available, people begin to gravitate towards them. And so I think, you know, when we start seeing studies from credible sources like the LSE, what they're in a sense confirming is that, you know, where you offer up good services at good prices that offer the kind of convenience people are looking for, a lot of people are going to go there. And the value that they associate with, or the desirability that they have when it comes to some of the infringing options, really recede to the background. And where, you know, where they ultimately reach conclusions that it's not having a big bottom line impact is it's a function that the industry itself hasn't entered the marketplace in an effective enough way to offer up a viable alternative to begin to selling to precisely the same people that they say are now engaged in some of these activities.
So the goal of the London School of Economics study, when you listen to its authors defending it against the MPAA attack, was to debunk the idea, and this is quoting one of them, that the internet is killing the video stars, and to review existing copyright law based on an analysis that strikes a balance among the interests of everyone from copyright holders to internet providers and internet users. That seems like a really valid approach that I would hope more and more lawmakers would adopt. Tom, are you optimistic that they are doing so?
What, that the lawmakers are doing so?
Yeah.
Or that they're listening to? No, I'm probably not, at least not yet. I think that is a discussion that would shed some light on why Lawrence Lessig has moved into fighting campaign finance reform versus copyright law, because I think it's going to take a lot of change in our government before we can actually have a decent discussion here in the United States anyway about that sort of thing. I do think that as the executives in media companies get older and younger people move up in the ranks who've grown up with the internet and have seen this, that it's hopeful that maybe the industry is starting to get it and say, you know what, we've learned from what happened with iTunes to the music industry. We're looking, and we hear HBO saying similar things like, you know what? We think it's a compliment that Game of Thrones is pirated. We don't like it. We don't think it should be legal. But we also understand that it means that our show is popular and actually gives us a lift. And if you look at the publishing industry, I was talking with Rob Reed about this on the Sword and Laser podcast I do. He is the one of the founders of Rhapsody back in the day. So he saw that music industry hit the internet firsthand. And now he's an author. And he points out that the publishing industry is going about things in quite a different manner. You don't hear them out in the media hammering away. Maybe that's because they know the MPAA will do it for them and they don't have to. But Rob's theory was that they have learned and realized that the way to compete with piracy is just not to give it any attention, but to provide an easier way to get books, which Amazon has thankfully provided them, and now Apple has, and there are plenty of ways to do that, and to compete on price, which is why they have fought for that in the United States, that price flexibility. They're more concerned with controlling the price of the good so they can do things like sales and give away free versions of books and make it easy for people to get books legally so that they just don't concern themselves with piracy. So if I have to find a little hope, that's one of the pieces of hope that I can latch onto.
Right. Well, that was one of the themes of the triangulation show that you did with Professor Geist back in December of 2010, was that maybe 20 or 30 years down the road, we will no longer be having this kind of tension and discussion around the antiquated nature of copyright laws, because people will have realized that the old business models don't work And they will realize that we've got to alter copyright law in order for businesses to be able to compete. So we're almost three years down the road. Tom, do you feel like we've moved a little bit toward that end?
I don't feel like the progress has been made as much as I would have hoped it would have been made legally. It looks like people are still considering stronger copyright protections. Instead of getting to the point where we actually have a real discussion about what the aim of copyright should be, as I mentioned earlier, and how do we achieve that aim? These sort of studies from the London School of Economics are great, but they're coming at it from the other end of the problem. They're attacking the justification for increasing the penalties, but not for why we have the law in the first place.
Right. Evan, do you think that the LSE weighing in on this issue? Obviously, studies come out from all sorts of sources on both sides of the debate, but this is a pretty well-established and well-respected source.
It is, and you can certainly hear the voice of reason speaking through what they're saying here, urging lawmakers to have a more objective approach, look to more objective criteria in determining what copyright policy should be. But, you know, what I hear us all saying here is that, you know, this is a much more complex problem. It's been a business model failure, and that really is the pain point for big content here is that it's broken down and the sales aren't what the record industry, the movie industry would have hoped. But therein lies the real problem here. It's time to transcend this question as to whether or not piracy is helpful or harmful to content, to the content industry, because it doesn't make any sense for anyone to look at what the entertainment industry's expectations should be based on what they were in the 1990s. What I'm saying is that it's an incredibly complex marketplace now, different than what it was in the height of the CD, whenever that was, probably the late 90s. I think I've seen data where there were, you know, the triumph of the CD and physical media. Because look at how different it is and how it's growing in complexity in the ways that we consume media, mobile devices. There are much more to choose from. Enter here all of the factors of the long tail and all of that. There's just so much more content to consume, so many more varieties here. So that leads me to think that, well, yes, copyright reform is extremely important. It's got to happen for all the reasons that we were talking about, you know, the bad things about U.S. copyright law in the first part of our conversation here. But really what it is taking it out of a legal discussion or making the legal questions not the right, not the focus of what needs to be talked about here, but the business model approach to it. And that's, I think, tacks on very well to what the London School of Economics is saying here. Lawmakers, look at the real objective marketplace business factors that are at play here.
All right. Well, another tie-in to our previous TPP discussion comes from Japan, where just about a year ago, they enacted criminal provisions for downloading copyrighted material without permission. Ultimately, people could face a 2-year jail sentence for downloading a song illegally in Japan. So the music industry there embraced this law, probably lobbied for this law, and with the hope, no doubt, that it would enhance their sales. Well, it turns out a year into the law, that's not what is happening. The music sales this year are down 7% over the same period last year. And digital sales of music in particular are down 24% since the law was introduced. So I guess, and there's a wonderful write-up at Torrent Freak about this that's also points out that what has happened is people are not going out and either buying the physical good for the music or downloading the digital file. But what they are doing is renting CDs. There's been a dramatic increase, 50% in CD rentals. And what the Torrent Freak author speculates is perhaps those rented albums aren't simply being listened to and returned. So Professor Geist, what does this tell us, this sort of experiment and observation of what's been happening in Japan about the efficacy of criminal copyright penalties?
Well, I think it tells us, excuse me, what we've long known, or at least long suspected, and that is that the notion that, that strong criminal penalties, the idea you're going to throw somebody in jail or slap them with millions or hundreds of millions of dollars potential liability for especially cases of non-commercial infringement, are just completely ineffective. Like, most people aren't aware generally of the of those rules, and if they are, they figure they're never likely to be a target. And further, I think that they expect, were this ever to really happen, that that rationality would prevail on the part of a judge or on a prosecutor, and that's just simply not going to happen. I don't think that you build up a business on the basis of sticks that ultimately claim we're going to throw you in jail or we're going to have very tough penalties if you engage in activity that runs afoul of the law. I think the better way is with the honey, in a sense, is to come up with viable competing business models that are out there. And it's interesting that you referenced the issue of rentals, because when I was doing research a number of years ago, back on some of the early Canadian copyright reform issues, we did enact an issue around a rental right, which applies in a number of different places, though not, of course, to videos, because the cat was already out, that it was too late to try to just to stop that from happening. And I recall looking back at some of the hearings around this rental right, and one of the issues that was raised with the industry was, you know, if we give you this exclusive right to rent, will you turn around and offer up services that are based on this notion of rental? So essentially, are we providing you with protection so that you can then enter into the marketplace with some competitors? And the industry said, oh, yes, of course, that's what we intend to do. But of course, the notion of rental scarcely ever entered into the marketplace after that. This was really just a way to shut down potential competitors as opposed to coming up with new kinds of models. And so it's interesting to hear that those same kinds of issues are still being replicated. And even more troubling to hear that, you know, there are countries that are still, in a sense, trying to bet that the way that, that you solve some of the business issues is through tough legal restrictions. And in the case of Japan, Japan over the last number of years, for whatever reason, has really tried to push itself to be up at the forefront of these kinds of rules. It was the first to ratify the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement. And even as we were talking about earlier on this issue of copyright term extension, Japan has already started talking about extending its term of copyright from life plus 50 to life plus 70, again, largely in anticipation of the TPP. So if anything, it seems like Japanese lawmakers haven't really gotten the message about what works and what doesn't, at least if we take a look at some of the other countries around the world.
Right, Tom, it seems like we can't be very far from if the rental business is on fire in Japan, there's going to be some sort of CD encryption scheme put into place there, and we're going to have the whole DCSS thing transpire once again, history repeating itself, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, the internet always finds a way around, right? Mm-hmm. If anything, perhaps these laws do cause innovation, just not in the right markets. They cause innovation in storage and encryption and ways of getting around the law. I think it is interesting to see a little bump in the CD sales there. You know, we don't know exactly why that is. There could be other factors, but it's interesting to consider it as a small percentage saying, okay, if you're going to have that law, this is what I'm going to do. And don't forget that Hadopi in France was never shown to do anything to boost sales there. And they have changed that system from being about internet disconnection to being about automatic fines, because that was less controversial and easier to implement. But it still isn't doing anything to stimulate the sales of music. And I keep repeating this, but sales isn't the end game. Sales is just one way of measuring creative output. Creative output is the end game. And the internet has made it easier than ever to produce creative works. So we're never having a conversation of, are we really going to run out of creative works? Are we going to run out of quality creative works? Maybe that's a conversation. And I'm not saying we shouldn't have any kind of intellectual property protections, but we need to have reasonable ones. And it shouldn't always be about the business models, because if we had less restrictive copyright laws, we'd have more innovative business models. At least that's my belief.
Evan, what do you think about the notion of criminal penalties? Is there a way where they could actually work and be effective? Or is this just something that's way off the charts and overreaction to the actual transgression?
I'm sure they could work and be effective, but not in the way of being effective that everybody would want here. I just can't see somebody going to jail for downloading music or, you know, violating copyright. Let's just make it much more more general. I'm thinking of the guy who leaked the Guns N' Roses album a few years ago. Wasn't he held criminally liable for that? I mean, I just can't see how that's actually going to win the hearts and the minds of the consumer. It's just something that's going to turn somebody away from this whole area of interest and do something else, you know, take up knitting or something like that instead of listening to music. I just can't see how it would be effective in the way that the copyright owners would benefit from it, because it seems like the natural human impulse would just really be repulsed by that possibility. And I can't tell if that's what is happening in Japan or not. I mean, all the data is so complex and, you know, I admit I don't have a keen sense of what's going on in the street in Japan, you know, with the sensibilities of people. But it seems like there could be some of that there.
Tom's heckling you in IRC. Watch out for those knitting pattern rights holders, Evan.
Yes, that probably made somebody angry.
Yeah, there actually is a little subculture of that with people suing each other. That's only a half a joke.
Yeah, no, really. My mom's a knitter, and you're absolutely right. There is. well, let us slide into a less entertainment-oriented copyright discussion. Because, of course, copyright applies to all sorts of media and records, including, and we've talked about this notion on the show a number of times now, just our digital history. The fact that as more and more things become digitized, you're not going to have file cabinets full of records that can be dusted off and accessed years down the road to show you what happened, boxes full of photographs or anything else. As everything becomes digital, access becomes very important. And I guess in Canada, this is becoming quite an issue, isn't it, Professor Geist, in connection with a digitization project there that at first had represented itself as giving quite broad public access. It's called the Heritage Project. But now in practice is looking like it may put things behind a paywall that people are very much going to want access to. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. And I think it's an issue that's being replicated in countries around the world. And I think it's less actually about stuff that's born digital or stuff that's easily turned digital as most works today would be, and more about our history and our heritage, which in an environment where almost everything the way people access work is mediated through digital. If it's not available that way, then it's largely inaccessible. And so the question is, how do you go turn around and find the funding and ability to support mass digitization of works? And of course, we've had controversy and litigation over some initiatives, notably the Google Book Search activities, as well as some of the digitization and uses thereof with HathiTrust in the United States. In Canada, our government has not been particularly supportive. And one proposal, which should have been a good news story, an effort to digitize 60 million historical works, largely contained right now on microfiche, and the idea was both to digitize them and then create both metadata and some amount of transcription so that they would be made more openly and readily available to anybody who wanted to access them. All of these documents, either public domain documents or government documents, so there was no copyright issue here. But the way that the parties went about trying to get this done, and the parties in this case would be Library and Archives Canada, which would be an agency of a department within the federal government, as well as a large number of research libraries affiliated with universities across the country, was in a sense a bit odd. And so much of the digitization was still scheduled to take place, or is scheduled to take place, from within the National Library. But the university said, we'll kick in about a third of the digitization and we'll engage in some crowdsourcing activity or other activities to create the metadata and some amount of the transcription. In return, they said, for that activity, for the bit of digitization and some of the hosting as well as the transcription, we'd like 10 years of exclusivity to these otherwise public documents. And the vision was that they said, well, every year we'll provide about a 10% of those documents available, openly available. And by the end of the 10 years, after a decade, it'll all be made available under a Creative Commons license or other open license. Now, of course, in 10 years' time, this is great. We'll have all this stuff made openly available. But it really raised, I think, some troubling questions amongst many, both in the library community, archivist community, and generally those that are concerned about overreach in terms of limiting access, to say that, you know, Library and Archives Canada, government department, just didn't have the right to take works that are otherwise public domain and give anybody exclusivity. And further, the notion of saying that these works would be made available on a 10-year basis, only over a 10-year period, while understandable to sort of provide some incentive for these libraries to participate, I think has struck many as simply being a wrong approach. And it's caused a fair amount of controversy, and it's unfortunate in the sense that the controversy has really erupted between groups that are traditionally allied and with the same goal, which is, of course, trying to find ways to bring more public access to heritage, to our public historical documents. And instead, what we've got is a lot of hurt feelings, a lot of question marks, and real concern about efforts that are happening essentially in the name of government that may result, at least for a period of time, in restrictions to works that are otherwise public documents.
Right. So even though, and I apologize for putting this in our copyright bucket, I was not aware that all of the documents included in this project were actually in the public domain to begin with. It seems, you know, very counterintuitive that simply digitizing them might make them then unavailable for review, despite the fact that there are no copyright restrictions coming into play here. But hearkening back to the triangulation show you did with us almost 3 years ago now, one of the points that you made there, or one of the bright spots that you touched on there, was the move in academia to make more and more scholarship that would be subject to copyright publicly available, and to, whether it's putting them in the public domain or just more freely licensing, making sure that people have open access to the latest scholarship on things. And I'm wondering, you know, 3 years down the road and sort of tying into this heritage project, if you see that trend continuing.
Yeah, that's been a good news, in many ways a great news story, mm-hmm. Where we have seen the trends towards open access really accelerate, where a number of some of the most high-profile universities, certainly in the United States, have established open access mandates requiring faculty members, when they publish, to ensure that they get at least a non-exclusive license to ensure that their research output can be made openly available, typically through what are referred to as institutional repositories, in other words, simply posted online so that anybody can have access. And in fact, a study out of Europe that came out late this summer indicated that a number of countries, including the United States, have reached what they described as a tipping point with respect to open access, indicating that now more than half of research scholarship is available under open access. These are sites like SSRN or a range of other sites that that scholars and researchers often use to, if not make the final version of their article openly available, often make a preprint or sometimes a postprint available. And it's, of course, searchable and readily accessible. So this has been a big success story. It's one that, you know, we're not there yet. There are still many that don't publish under open access, and so there's still too much work that is not accessible, and there have been some opposition from some of the major publishers who see this trend and have tried to stop it from happening. But what we are seeing is many scholars moving in this way, universities moving this way, and I think very importantly, many of the funders who fund research moving in this direction as well. And so what we've seen a lot do is establish effectively a quid pro quo, where they say, if you are going to take our research money, particularly for government-funded research, one of the requirements is that you make the resulting research openly available. And of course, if you don't have that, then you're effectively asking the public to at least pay twice for the same research. First, mm-hmm. to fund the research, and then second, essentially to buy it back again once it's published in fee-based subscriptions. So I think it makes a whole lot of sense, certainly from a taxpayer perspective. I think it makes sense from a broader access to knowledge perspective. And happily, it makes sense from a researcher perspective as well, because unsurprisingly, there have been a number of studies that have found that works that are made openly available tend to be cited more and have a larger impact. That's no surprise. If you make sure your work is more easily accessible to other researchers, they're more likely to read it and more likely to cite it.
Well, we're going to go ahead and let you go on that high note. We know you need to run, Professor Geist, but we so enjoyed speaking with you here today. We really appreciate your time and all the wonderful work you do. Really wonderful chatting with you today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It was great to catch up and talk about these issues. I have a feeling in 3 years' time, many of them are still going to be percolating in much the same way they are now.
I'm sure they will. Folks, do be sure to check out Professor Geist's blog at michaelgeist.ca and follow him on Twitter. He is a wonderful source of information on important topics. So, Professor Geist, have a wonderful weekend, and we hope to chat with you not too far down the road.
Great. Thanks very much. Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Hey, Tom, I guess Aaron Swartz never got the memo on what we were just discussing, that there is increased access to scholarship of the sort that it didn't need to be set free.
Yes, yeah, sadly, no. To tragic effect.
Yeah. Evan, this issue of public access to digital records in history is something that's near and dear to your heart. Do you think that this development in Canada is a bad sign?
Well, somebody's got to pay for it, so it's a real issue. It's just that the issue has to be resolved in the right way. I mean, you can't just get the resources to do this out of thin air. It's either got to come from public funding or be privately subsidized or what have you. But you're right, Denise. It is critically important in the digital age that we think about how we're going to preserve our human heritage for posterity, because even though digital information has the ability to be stored longer and not be as subject to corruption as what paper does, you know, there are also so many ways that that access to that can be restricted, and new forms of I want to say new forms of liability can arise from having access to that. I'm just thinking about, you know, ways. It's just that weird whole thing with exclusivity up in Canada, that exclusive arrangement for this one provider to have the distribution rights for that content for a limited period of time, even though it's not protected by copyright. That just it's just kind of weird, and something that could only happen in the digital age with digital distribution like that. So, yes, a critically important issue. And But you know, hey, at least in Canada, you know, you could get into the equivalent of whatever their national archives are. If you tried to go to Washington, D.C. and walk in now and see a copy of the Declaration of Independence, you couldn't do it. So maybe we've got bigger problems to solve before we get to that.
Yeah. Hey, you guys want to check in on Aereo for a minute here? There was an interesting story about them this week and development in their lawsuit.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So
no Aereo. Evan.
Oh, Aereo. Do you guys talk a lot about Aereo on Frame Rate, Tom?
We do. It's become like a regular beat story. We've got at least one, if not more, Aereo stories every week.
Yeah. So this week's has to do with the plaintiffs attempting to catch Aereo up on some of their statements, their representations that their technology is not substantially different than what consumers could do themselves with off-the-shelf kind of equipment. So now the broadcasters are trying to get access to Aereo's patents and their patent applications. So there's some jockeying before the court about whether some of that information might be privileged because of discussions with counsel involved in the applications. But the court, it looks like, is going to give them access to those patents. And the reason that they want the information is because they may contradict, you know, as you're filing a patent application, you're trying to establish how unique your technology is and how non-off-the-shelf. So they're trying to see what Aereo has had to say about making a product that is something other than what they've represented to the court. So that's been going on. It looks like the court is going to go ahead and let that discovery go forward. Were you surprised by this, Evan?
No, I mean, I don't think this is much of an issue here because, you know, the statements that you'd make in the patent application are for a different reason than what they were made in the hearing for the, was it a preliminary injunction? And mm-hmm. plus they were at different periods of time. The patent application was filed in 2011. This just happened recently. So, you know, the court is right to allow liberal discovery on this issue. What they're doing is allowing a limited deposition of the CEO and the CTO of Aereo. So I don't see this being a huge issue whatsoever. I think it's if we are try to look too much into it, we're conflating apples and oranges a little bit too much here. So
Yeah.
Do you get the sense that a lot of people are using Aereo, Tom?
You know, more and more. I mean, obviously it's only in a few markets, but I think it's got a nice little bundle of people. Obviously it's enough to keep Aereo in afloat to expand to other markets because they continue to announce new places. But I also don't think it's a critical mass. I don't hear of, you know, big waves of cable cancellation because people got Aereo. I think it's people who already don't have cable who are saying, you know what, I would like to have an easier way than my antenna on the roof that's kind of inconsistent to get these channels. So I'm going to plop down for this service. And I think the broadcast networks are being a little backwards in that they should be embracing this technology and maybe co-opting it a little bit and look to the future rather than fighting it. But they're going to fight it. And it sounds like they're going to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court because there's conflicting decisions with the David Alke Aereo killer in California, right, which still has to go to appeals, where they ruled that service was against the law. And Aereo seems to win most of the other cases, but those are all in the East Coast. So we've got kind of two systems going on.
Yes, you're right. That's the kind of thing that when we've got conflicting decisions and half the country living under one legal regime and the other half living under something entirely different that the Supreme Court may well get involved in. So
it doesn't sound like they're, from what I've been reading this week, that the Supreme Court is going to pick up the petition this coming session because the California Appeals Court on the Alke David service isn't done. It sounds more likely that they would hold off. And we could see this battle continue to go until 2015.
Right. Well, we will continue watching them. They're very interesting with all their little tiny dime-sized antennas. Also interesting, I think it's this issue. It's a case that we haven't discussed yet that deals with digital entrapment or entrapment in the digital age. And, you know, it's called Jeanette versus Florida. It was decided last month by a Florida court of appeal. And it's sort of the classic case where agents are trying to catch sexual predators. And but in this particular instance, they're using technology to do it. The defendant, Mr. Jeanette, was texting away with these agents without realizing that that's what was going on. And he thought he was texting with a young woman, I believe, who was represented to be of age, of legal consent age, who was suggesting that she might introduce him to someone else who was only 14. And their exchanges went on and on. And what wound up happening is, and I think it's pretty clear as you read through the case, they really did lead the guy, you know, when he seemed to be, you know, going another direction, they really did lead him to, are you sure, you know, you don't want to meet her, kind of thing. And they got him finally to go, okay. And so it seems to be a pretty classic case of entrapment, but not according to this court. The court said, you know, he was not solicited. Instead, the agents persuaded him, drawing a distinction there. And so it's an interesting case. And I think, you know, the fact that the texting medium was what was in play here was pretty important. Evan, what were your thoughts on this?
Well, just to be clear, the court did find that they had entrapped him, right? And so it reversed his conviction, right? Isn't that what happened here? in the case?
You know, yes, his sentence was reversed and dismissed.
Yes, so they did find that that they had entrapped him, right? I just want to make sure that okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I teed that up a bit off, but yes.
Good, yeah. I mean, this is what I really think was happening here was the judge sending a message to the cops, don't be such idiots when you're investigating someone, because it was like over a series of 30 or 40 emails that they sent to this guy to finally get him, you know, to go into the narrative of what you were talking about, to finally get him to sort of ambiguously say, okay, I'll hang out with your 14-year-old little sister. I mean, that's not effective law enforcement going out finding real predators on the internet. This is, you know, clearly, meets the elements of what entrapment are. If anything, just to set the cops straight and actually be, there are plenty of aggressive sexual predators out there on the internet that they ought to be going after. This guy wasn't one of them. My favorite line of the case was, what was it? It was, we isolated and brought it out. It says, this was after the investigators had sent him a few, the undercover investigators had sent him a few emails. It says, appellants, the defendant here, his emails at this point continued to discuss his pet possum.
So I got really distracted at that point of reading. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the police here say, nice pick. Why in the world do you have a pet possum? That's fishing, isn't it?
Yes. Fishing for something, that's for sure. So, this is, the cops, the investigators weren't doing their job on this. And I think that it's important that the court reached its decision here, because it just shows that it draws a line under the fact that these were wasted law enforcement resources and, wasted so much that even the conviction gets overturned. So don't do this anymore. Cops, actually go out there and catch real predators.
Right. I suppose it is easier to just send a bunch of texts than, Tom, any thoughts?
Well, I definitely got distracted with the possum conversation. And I guess that's where he sends the picture. So that transcript had to be in there, but it's pretty hilarious. I mean, what you do on text message carries the same responsibility of what you would say out loud. And both the appellant and the agents should realize that it doesn't absolve you of anything. It's still communication.
Yep. Denise, I'm asking you this, Tom, you're happily married, right? And Denise, I know you're married. I'm married. We're all married people here. But so I'm just asking for the benefit of any of the single guys listening or watching. Do girls like it when you send possum pictures? Is that something that you should do?
Let's just say it would be better than some other kinds of pictures that have been famously flashed around the internet in recent months. So, yes.
I don't think that word means what he thinks it means.
I'm speaking in the literal sense. Yes. Mm-hmm. Posing your possum is better than posing various other things that may not be a possum. All right, Evan.
Just ask.
Bad possum. We may as well make bad possum our second MCLA passphrase for this week in law, this episode, because we can. Gold darn it.
You know, we wouldn't have been talking about this if Michael Geist was still on the line. Notice how he gets off the line and we're just like talking about
possum crazy.
I saved the possum for you guys. Let's talk about Bitcoins. That's something we might have talked about with Michael Geist. And the fact that the FBI is now sitting on several billion dollars worth of them in the wake of the Silk Road shutdown. The FBI seized Silk Road's assets, which were primarily in the form of Bitcoin. So now the FBI has a whole lot of Bitcoins, as Cash Hill has written up over on her Forbes blog. And it's really quite a lot. $1.2 billion in sales from the site and some $80 million in commissions. And I think this is interesting, for all the reasons that Bitcoin is interesting. What will the FBI do with these Bitcoins? Will the anonymity of the users be preserved? What do you think, Evan? Is the FBI going to have a Bitcoin fire sale at some point?
Well, all I think of doing, and when I hear questions like this, is just, you know, call Jerry Brito, because he knows about, you know, how to answer these questions. Because, yes, you know, Bitcoin is, it you know, by design, it has mechanisms built in so that, you know, the authentication is important, but done anonymously and for all these reasons. So it seems, unlike real money, by its very nature, it seems to be resistant to this fact of being seized. And I don't know precisely how that is. I don't understand. I just confess, I don't understand enough about it to know. So there could be some weird aspect of it that goes along that, which then leads me to the question that I can really talk about. Well, what remedy would there be here for the owners of these seized Bitcoins to go after the FBI? Under what basis do you go into court and assert an ownership right to this? And what is the remedy for that? That brings in some economic questions as well. So I'm glad this happened so that we can, you know, perhaps get some answers out of this. Not, you know, this is all setting aside the issue of whether or not, and I think this was mentioned in one of the articles that were floating around about this, where the FBI agent was talking about how one cannot rightfully go seek to reclaim money or property which he or she illegally had or lost. So there's that aspect of it as well, you know, the illegal subject matter doctrine of it all.
Yes, if you're someone who had their Bitcoins seized by the FBI, you probably don't want to be knocking on their door asking for them back. In fact, when Cash Hill interviewed an FBI official about that, she just flat out laughed at Cash Hill and said, there's not likely to be restitution in this case. If they're knowingly buying something illegal, they can't get their money back. So, you know, don't be thinking you're going to get your money back from the FBI. Or if you are, then you've completely thwarted your, if anonymity was one of your goals of using Bitcoin, you've kind of thrown that out the window. Cash Hill points out that the FBI now holds about 5% of all Bitcoin currently in existence as of this seizure. What do you think about all this, Tom?
Yeah, this is really interesting because the 26,000 Bitcoins that would be available for restitution because they were in accounts of users of Silk Road are available. The FBI has access to them. The 600,000 Bitcoins that were Silk Road's, that were kind of sitting in the Silk Road account, are in the Bitcoin encrypted wallet. And the way that Bitcoin works, you have a wallet with a strong password, and it uses the Bitcoin network to verify the hashes of all those coins so that only you can have them. And I, having just transferred a Bitcoin wallet from one computer to another, it takes a long time. It takes like days if you only have 5 coins to validate that. And they don't have the password. So they don't have access to this wallet. And this is some pretty strong encryption here. So those 600,000 coins, they may not be able to get access and sell them. They may be off the market for quite a long time. That's 5% of the Bitcoins, close to it, with 600,000 being the predominant amount. That's going to reduce the supply of Bitcoins. And it'll be interesting to see what effect that has on the Bitcoin market long term, if that were to stay permanently out of circulation, because the whole Bitcoin market was built with this maximum amount of Bitcoins in mind and a little bit of loss. But this is quite a bit of loss all at once.
This is an encryption that the NSA developed, right? Because they could just call over to the next office.
Well, right. It calls out that card, right? It says, okay, how much access, backdoor access to encryption do you really have? I don't think they could crack this, again, very easily. Nothing is uncrackable, but it takes time.
So to tee up our tip of the week, I want to ask you guys if you think it's a big deal at all that you can't hide on Facebook anymore, that your profile, even if it is as private as you can make it, is going to show up in search. It's been getting a bit of coverage this week. I don't think it really is much surprise that Facebook has gone in this direction. There are some bummed out users. Do you think this is a big deal, Tom?
This is a big deal because it's Facebook, and whenever Facebook and privacy are mentioned in the same breath, everybody freaks out. It's a little bit of a big deal because there is a slice of people who use Facebook who don't want to be searchable. Maybe they still want to have an account, but they don't want anyone to know it. Maybe they have a stalker or an ex or somebody that they just don't feel comfortable with them finding. And what this changes, they can still set their privacy settings so that no one can see anything on their actual account. They can say it's only friends that I approve, but they can't change the setting to prevent the name from showing up in search. And that's what's got people a little upset, is I don't want that to be there. Facebook says, well, that is not, you know, the way Facebook works, it's confusing if you say, I don't want my name in search, but maybe you're in a group with someone and they can see your posts in that group. And then when they go to search for you, you don't exist. We want to use all this stuff consistently. And so the solution is to let names be searchable, but you control who can access the actual pieces of content.
Right. Evan, what do you think? Is this going to be trouble for Facebook, or are they able to manipulate their system however they'd like?
Well, I trust it's probably not that, in the end, it's not going to make a big deal. With the end users, there have been actions before, you know, where Facebook has done things, and it's not been of lasting consequence. You can't find me on Facebook, but that's not because of this feature. So
right. But you know, there are some people, and I think I may be one of them. You know, I'm not on top of all of my Facebook settings, but there are people who go ahead and check that box. Please opt me out of search. And that's just going to go away now. So that user choice isn't going to be acknowledged. But again, back to Cash Hill, she is responsible for our tip of the week this week, which is how you can easily opt out of Google's plan to do something finally with your plus ones in their ecosystem. They're making its change its terms of service that will allow it to share plus ones both within its ecosystem, and that people go around and, you know, when you see a site that has the ability to plus one something, that actually gets saved in your Google account. And now they're actually going to be using that metadata and monetizing it. But they are making it easy to opt out of it if you'd like. And Cash Hill has an article about it. It is pretty simple. You go to google.com/settings/endorsements, I believe is the link. And then you'll find a box that allows you to opt out of shared endorsements in ads. And that's all you do to opt out. So it is a bit different than the Facebook universe, where things have been sort of notoriously difficult to find and opt out of. This one is pretty simple. Especially in the advertising arm of Facebook, when you're opting out of social things and sharing, that can be pretty convoluted. So it looks like Google's taking a different approach here. And if you're interested in not being having your plus ones shared around, they are making it easy. So go ahead and check that out if you are so inclined. And then our resource of the week comes from the EFF. And they have a really nice explainer on, and you guys were just alluding to this, you know, how much is your encryption really able to, or your ability to break encryption really able to get you places, federal government. This article is on how the NSA deploys malware, an in-depth look at the revelations from The Guardian. Bruce Schneier has been going through the Snowden documents, and there's a really good explanation here on what's going on as far as he can tell. And also at the end, some tips on what users can do to protect themselves and what browsers can do to make themselves less vulnerable to this kind of malware. So it's sort of win-win that this information is coming out and being reviewed. Evan, any thoughts on this or on opting out of plus ones?
Well, you know, this was helpful from the EFF, you know, talking about these different things and, you know, opting out of the plus ones, you know, I mean, sure. I think that's useful as well. But again, it is something that's really irritating. And I just, you know, personally try to avoid it all in the first place, just try to be monetized as little as possible through lack of use. And is it a surprise that this is what Google's trying to do? Not at all.
If there were a service, Evan, that allowed you to select who you were sharing that information with, as opposed to having a third party like Facebook or Google as the gatekeeper, if you were in charge of all of your data and could share it out as you see fit, would you be more interested in that kind of a universe?
I think so. You know, because that's one of the big reasons why I do eschew so much social media. Mm-hmm. Like that, you know, I really enjoy Twitter because it's very simple, and I don't think that there's a real complex high resolution picture that the platform can paint of me based on my use of Twitter. So, you know, and wasn't that, I mean, I've kind of lost track of what was it called? Diaspora, whatever became of that, Tom, I mean, do you, whatever became, cause it wasn't that kind of just more, it was because of its decentralized nature. You know, by design, it was a little bit, you know, catered to those sensibilities.
AppNet and others, it's still around. It still has its devotees, but it has not gotten widespread acceptance. So it just kind of perks along in the corner. Identica, all of those.
Mm-hmm. I remember Identica. I just pulled up Diaspora. It has gone nonprofit, it says. Not that I don't know that it would have been a very effective for profit.
No, I think it was always open source, so I'm not not sure what the change is there.
Yes, I think the change is, you know, whether they plan to make money from it or not.
They've decided they can't, and so they won't.
That's a very good business strategy when you're not making money. We are declaring ourselves a nonprofit.
Right, a not profit, just not profit. You know, a minor point of clarification on the Google Plus story.
Yes.
Plus ones were the thing that were already allowed to be monetized in the current terms of service. It's everything else that they're adding starting November 11th, which is your comments, your reviews, your ratings, and comments and posts that you make on YouTube, et cetera. Those, now that they're all part of Google Plus, will now also be added to the monetization. So if you already opted out of them, allowing your plus ones to be shown with the ads, you're already opted out. But if you never did, or you never knew they were doing that, then you would need to go do this before November 11th.
Right. So here's the actual text that you get from Google. The setting below allows you to limit use of your name and photo in shared endorsements and ads. It applies only to actions that Google displays within ads. The summertime spas example above shows a shared endorsement appearing in an ad on Google search. Changing this setting does not impact how your name and photo might look in a shared endorsement that is not in an ad. For example, when you share a music recommendation that is displayed in the Play Store, you can limit the visibility of outside activity of ads by deleting the activity or changing its visibility settings. And then you have a box to tick that if you tick it, you're telling Google, based on my activity, Google may show my name and profile photo in shared endorsements that appear in ads, and then you save it. So it looks like they're making the sharing opt-in as well, which is a good thing.
Yeah, that would be a good thing if that's the way it's working. I'm always for that, definitely. I don't really have a problem with this, the way they've implemented it, because it's like, let's say I plus one Twit, right? And then Twit buys an ad on Google search. And when the search comes up, it says Twit. And then below it said plus one to buy the following people in your circles, right? That makes sense to me. I don't come to an unfair conclusion that they're getting paid or that they're overly endorsing it. But the terms of service allow them to do other things in the future that I may not be comfortable with. That's usually why I opt out of this kind of stuff.
Yeah. So hence our tip for others who are like-minded. And I think we'll go ahead and bring this one in for a landing. Tom, I'm so glad that you could join us. It's always great to have you on the show.
Well, thanks, Denise. It's always fun to be on this show. Some of my favorite things to talk about are things that you guys talk about all the time. And I learn from you guys, and especially when you have great guests like Michael Geist.
Yes. And so tell us about, you know, Southern California now that you're living in the heart of the entertainment industry. Is this changing your outlook on any of this at all?
Yeah, I haven't gotten a tan or anything. No, it is interesting. The conversations you overhear are much more entertainment industry when you're like out to dinner or talking with people versus the tech industry. Mm-hmm. And maybe I don't know if I really do pick up on certain news bits more because they're local. I get all my news through the internet anyway. I don't think it's radically changed things, but there seems to always be more and more to talk about regarding cord cutting, which is what we cover on frame rate, whether it's because I'm here or not. I don't know.
Absolutely. Hey, Evan, great chatting with you too.
The same. Yeah, really enjoyed it. That was quite a conversation we had with Professor Geist, and it's been fun. The three of us hanging out here too. I've enjoyed it. It's a great way to wrap up the week.
It has. And I know people in IRC have been asking for links to some of the stuff we discussed. Of course, you can find links to everything we discussed if you head on over to delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/231. That's this episode. And you can find all that you would need there to go back through and see what we reviewed in getting ready for the show. Also, really encourage you to follow along with Professor Geist's writings in Canada. He's definitely at ground zero of a lot of very important policy and law developments that affect everyone that listens to this show. If you enjoy listening to the show, we thank you. We're so glad that you do, and hope that you'll join us on Fridays at 11 o'clock Pacific time when we record live. It's always fun to have you along as a live audience and jumping in the IRC at irc.twit.tv. But if you can't do that, don't worry. It's all available for you on demand, sans paywall. Go to twit.tv/twill, and our archive of shows is there, also on YouTube, which I'm noticing is terribly convenient as more and more televisions, you know, you don't need a set-top box to bring in that internet content. They're coming with the ability to access things like YouTube right out of the box. So if you're someone who prefers watching this kind of show in your living room, check out your TV and its built-in apps. It may make it easy for you to do that. We're at youtube.com/thisweekinlaw, also on Roku and in iTunes, and otherwise just happy to be there for you however you'd like to join us. We encourage you to join us between the shows too. Head on over to our Facebook page or our Google Plus page to let us know what you liked, what you think we should be talking about, what amazing thing happened in your area that we might not otherwise hear about. We love those tips and suggestions as we get the show ready to bring you each week. And we love getting your thoughts on how the law is developing and whether the 20 to 30 year time frame is unfolding any more rapidly in your neck of the woods as to making copyright law make sense for the way people use the internet and need to go on with their lives. So keep us posted. You can email us. I'm Denise@twit.tv. Evan is Evan@twit.tv. And follow all of us on Twitter. Of course, Tom is the great Ace Detect. I'm D Howell. And Evan is Internet Cases, where he also has a great blog at internetcases.com. And also writes about in detail some of the most interesting developments at the juncture of the law and technology. So thanks so much, guys. It's been a really fun way to spend this part of the day. And I'll catch up with both of you soon, I hope.